The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After a long, harsh winter in New Hampshire, the weather is warm and inviting, and the great outdoors beckons. But the forecast for the so-called tick season is less inviting, with tick populations thriving in many parts of the state and an ever-rising number of confirmed Lyme disease cases, an illness carried by the black-legged tick. Still, we do know a lot more about ticks and Lyme prevention than we did 20 years ago, and just recently, much of that information was cataloged in a new report from the Department of Health and Human Services called State of New Hampshire Tick-Borne Disease Prevention Plan. It covers the trends and the numbers, gives detailed information about personal protection, and it outlines new approaches toward backyard and community landscaping that could have dramatic benefits toward reducing tick-friendly habitat. Today in The Exchange, we dive back into the world of ticks, including new data and emerging ideas. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in the studio. Abby Mathewson is here. She's state public health veterinarian with New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. She worked on that report I mentioned, which you can find on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Abby, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Dr. Ben Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's also an infectious disease physician. And Dr. Chan, good to meet you too. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Alan Eaton, UNH Cooperative Extension entomologist. Alan has been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for 25 years. And Alan, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Alan, as I said, you've been studying ticks for a long time. What changes have you seen in terms of the number of ticks, the spread of ticks, how often they're carrying Lyme disease?
In our state, in particular, the black-legged tick, the population has been going up and up and up and up. And so we're seeing higher numbers, but also the geographic distribution is a little different. It used to be strongly associated with the seacoast, and now it's found in every county, and I've been actively working to fill in that map. So there's one thing that's dramatically changed.
The numbers and the spread of their location, if we could put it
that way. When we look at deer, I'll give you some data from our deer studies. It's just astonishing in some of the places. It's gone from zero infestation on the deer to close to 100 in some cases.
And you talked about deer, and you corrected me a couple of years ago, Alan. We used to talk about black-legged ticks as deer ticks, and those were the villains in this story. But it's not a deer tick. It's a black-legged tick.
Black-legged is the correct name. For a short time, it was called deer tick, but then the name changed. That's a long story. Okay. If we had a two-hour show, we could talk about
that. Well, give us a little bit of that. That's interesting.
It started out the Harvard entomologists who described this new species, as they were calling it, associated with a new disease called Lyme disease.
This is back in the 70s,
saw
right?
Saw enough differences, yes. That they called it a new species, and they called it Damini, named after Damon, an entomologist at Harvard. And I looked at the two species, supposedly different species. I couldn't tell them apart. And then we had an entomologist at the National Tick Collection down in Statesboro, Georgia, who did a series of studies for several years, breeding the males of supposedly one species to the females of the other and vice versa, and they all produced viable offspring. When they can mate and produce viable offspring, that means they're the same species.
Yeah.
So that's, after that work was done, that's why the name changed.
All right. Well, and later on we'll talk about, you know, who else carries these black-legged ticks besides
yes.
deers. From what I understand, the white-footed mouse is kind of a culprit. You don't want to pick on the mouse, but
on the white-footed mice. Yeah. They are the major, they're the best reservoir host here in our state.
Okay. Well, Dr. Chan, so if I'm bitten by a tick, I get that bullseye rash. What are the chances of me getting Lyme disease?
Well, so it's unclear exactly how often people that are bitten by a tick get Lyme disease. We know that Lyme disease is very prevalent in the population. And just to be clear, the Lyme disease is a disease caused by infection with a bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi, which is a spiral-shaped bacteria. We call it a spirochete. And it takes about 2 or 3 days for the bacteria to migrate from the belly of the tick into the person, causing an infection. So there's a lot of factors that go into getting an infection after the bite from a tick, part of which is the length that a tick is attached. In the early stages of Lyme disease, we think that about 70 or 80% of people will get that bullseye rash, and that's pretty diagnostic of Lyme disease. And certainly if somebody sees a rash like that, they should call their healthcare provider because there are ways that Lyme disease can be treated. Additionally, if there is a tick bite, there are ways to try and prevent Lyme disease with antibiotics. And so if a person has a concerning tick bite, they can also call their healthcare provider and perhaps get a prescription for antibiotics to prevent the development of infection.
So some of the hints besides that bullseye rash, because you said 70% get it, so that means another 30% don't. What are some of the other hints that you might have a problem?
Well, so there are different stages of Lyme disease. There's the early stage where you can see the bullseye rash. You know, people can also develop other nonspecific symptoms, so just feeling really tired, having muscle aches, generalized muscle aches and joint aches. Sometimes people can have fevers and chills. People can have asymptomatic infection as well and go unrecognized as having Lyme disease. Later in the course of illness, so we're talking weeks to months and even years later, if somebody has been infected and doesn't recognize it, there can be some pretty serious complications. inflammation of the heart muscle,
wow.
A central nervous system infections, meningitis, that means inflammation of the meninges, that's the lining around the spinal cord. People can develop more intense swelling and pain in some of the large joints like the knees. And so it's important to, one, recognize a tick bite, when people see it, and also recognize the early stages of disease because we want to try and prevent the complications later on.
Yeah, that's serious stuff. And real quick, you know, I'm listening to you talk, Dr. Chan. I'm thinking, you know, fever, aches, tired, not feeling good. I mean, I've got two kids. I mean, that could describe them on any given day. You know, I don't feel good. I don't want to go to school. So, I mean, how do you kind of move beyond and get that important diagnosis?
Right. And that's a great question. And that's one of the difficulties with diagnosing Lyme disease is that some of the symptoms can be found in many other common illnesses. That's why it's important to recognize the rash because it's pretty typical for Lyme disease. And it's also important to recognize a tick bite when you have one. The majority of cases of Lyme disease are going to show up during tick season, which is around May to September. And if somebody comes down with symptoms nonspecific symptoms, you know, during flu season, more likely than not, it's not Lyme disease. So the timing of the symptoms is important as well.
How aware, Abby, do you think most Granite Staters are about ticks, about the threats, about what they need to do?
Well, I think there is definitely room for improvement in that area, which is part of the reason why across multiple state agencies, we wanted to try and develop a state plan that talked about different methods of prevention, what the risks are, what the changes have been in our state that people have been noticing over time, especially like Dr. Eaton, with the changes in ticks and maybe sources of that. So changing in landscape, which we talk a little bit about in the plan too.
Yeah, and the
changes in wildlife populations.
The landscaping is really interesting, and I definitely want to ask you about that. Where would you say, Abby, given, you know, your work on this for a number of years now, where are the gaps in most people's knowledge or gaps in most people's actions? Maybe we know, but we don't do what we're supposed to do.
Well, I think everybody I would hope that everybody in the state would understand the importance of wearing repellents and doing tick checks, which are two of the very basic personal protective measures that a person can do in any area that you're going to be exposed to ticks to. But I don't think that is done uniformly. And there are still a lot of people doing those old wives' tales tick removals where they're traumatically removing the ticks when they shouldn't do that, because that actually increases the risk of transmission of not just Lyme disease, but the ticks we have in New Hampshire also carry and transmit Anaplasma, Babesia. We've had one case of Powassan virus.
Those are the other scary viruses, right, that they carry. So when you say dramatic removal, you mean, like, give us what you mean there.
Well, using burning matches, using kerosene, using nail polish to suffocate or do something to try and get the ticks to back out quickly. But the ticks can't back out quickly because of the way – and Dr. Eaton, again, might want to talk more about the actual biology of the tick, but they've got barbs on their mouth parts, so they can't pull out quickly. And they also secrete a cement to help stay attached. So they can't quickly remove themselves. So the best way to do tick removal is just a slow, steady traction to pull it out.
All right. And here are two Facebook comments on that very important issue that you raise, Abby, about tick checks. And I'll throw this to you, Alan. Janelle says a tick check every day will keep doctor visits away. Thank you, Janelle. Also on Facebook, Jamie says, how can parents even detect the smallest variety of ticks on their children or themselves? They are almost too small to see. Jamie says, what can be done to avoid them and their bites? And Alan Eaton, unfortunately, is radio. You've brought in a bunch of tick samples, and some of the ticks that are most worrisome are also teeny, teeny, teeny.
And it's good. I'm especially pleased that you had this particular show now, because we're just commencing the riskiest time of the entire year. That's when the nymphs of black-legged tick are beginning to be active. And so the nymphs are the smallest infective stage. They're only a millimeter long, so it can be hard. But if you check yourself regularly, most of us, I have light skin. I know where my freckles are. And so when you give the kids a bath every night and so forth, you know where the freckles are. You learn if you've got a freckle in a new spot that wasn't there before, there's a warning thing to look for. And they really are almost black in a color, and it's the adult females when they start or have a little bit of orangey red, but you'll notice something that's different that wasn't there before, and it really pays big dividends to check.
And again, looking at the ticks you have, the adults, yeah, I could probably see that, but the nymphs, Alan, I don't know if I would see that.
1 millimeter is small. Of course, the adult female of black-legged is 3 millimeters. That's a little bit bigger. I use Food References a lot, so sesame seed size for the adult female, whereas a poppy seed size for the nymph.
Yeah.
But again, comparing it, if you've got a freckle where it wasn't before, it's worth bearing out. Put on your glasses and look close up. And then, just like Abby said, remove it. Remove it right away.
Well, Janelle and Jamie, thank you for the Facebook comments. After a short break, I've got some emails, some more Facebook thoughts, also some callers to share with you, and lots more questions, including for you, Dr. Chan, why there's no vaccine. We'll talk about all that in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. More on ticks and tick-borne diseases this hour in The Exchange. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the numbers, the trends, and some of the results from a new study from the Department of Health and Human Services about tick prevention. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dr. Chan, here's a couple Facebook comments that I did want to share with you. Stephanie says, why still no vaccine for humans, even if it only helps against a few strains, better than nothing? James says, why not make the Lyme disease vaccine available to those who want it? Jason says, bring back the vaccine. And Shana says, I want to know why there isn't a Lyme vaccine. And I have this question, too. Thanks to all those folks. What happened to the vaccine? We used to have one, right, back in the 2000s?
We did, and that's a great question. You know, there was a vaccine that was developed, I believe, in the 1990s, and it was taken off the market in 2002,
right,
largely because of demand for it. Now, there is still a vaccine, I believe, that's used in animals, and so you can still vaccinate animals against Lyme disease. Part of it was that I think the demand for the vaccine was low. You know, that was over a decade ago now, and so there may be new demand for the vaccine. And also the efficacy of the vaccine after a couple of doses is only about 50% effective, I believe, and after three doses it went up to 75% effective. So not a great vaccine in the grand scheme of things when we're talking about other vaccines like the MMR vaccine for measles that has, 99% efficacy, but still offered some protection. And
75% sounds pretty good to me.
Right. And that's around what we use, on a good season, 60, 70% for the flu vaccine. So I think there is more, as your callers have noted, there is more demand for a vaccine. And I believe there is some look into developing or bringing back a vaccine, although I don't believe it's going to be in the near future. But I think there is some work on developing a new vaccine.
Yeah, I've heard that they are doing testing in Europe.
Yes.
It is so frustrating, though, Dr. Chan, for people to learn that, again, there used to be a vaccine and it went out of business in the early 2000s. As you said, that's very, very frustrating for folks who just want to get outside and enjoy their time. I know myself, I love getting outside in the warm weather. And I don't know, it just seems like the system should work better than that.
Yeah, and even if there was a vaccine, I think that some of the steps that are outlined in the tick-borne disease prevention plan would still apply because no vaccine is 100% effective. excuse me. And so even if there was a vaccine available and people were to get a vaccine, the general recommendations would still apply to, do tick checks, wear DEET insect repellent, wear long clothes, long pants, long sleeves, and do tick checks after you're outside. Because, again, no vaccine is 100%, and so you could still get Lyme disease or some other tick-borne illness.
All right. Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to the phones. Anne's joining us from Hanover. Hi, Anne. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Several years ago, I had Lyme disease. I didn't know what it was when I had it. We were away from home, and I just felt miserable. Got back home and had a phone call from my doctor who said, go immediately and get I've forgotten now what it was. And I took it, and I've never had it since. But I never had the rash.
You were one of that 30% that you talked about, Dr. Chan, who didn't have the rash, and that's still a fair number of people.
It is a fair number, and this statistic is debated, whether it's 70 or 80% or lower. But there are people that get a tick bite and don't necessarily develop a rash or don't recognize the rash. Sometimes the tick bites can be in places that are not always visible, and people don't always notice the rash right away. But if there is the rash, people should call their primary care provider because it is a pretty typical and diagnostic sign of Lyme disease. There are different ways of detecting Lyme disease, not just with the rash. There are blood tests that can detect the antibody response to infection. But those antibodies take up to 4 weeks or more to develop. And so
there is
no reliable blood test or diagnostic test in the very, very early stages of Lyme disease, that being the first few weeks to diagnose Lyme disease. And for that reason, if somebody were to develop this bullseye rash, that's enough of a symptom or a sign for a doctor to diagnose Lyme disease and treat without any blood testing.
Well, and in the absence of a vaccine, so let's talk a little bit more about prevention. And again, there are a lot of strategies outlined in this report that you guys worked on, Abby. I thought it was interesting the way it talked about disruptions in the natural landscape and how that has played into these thriving tick populations in New Hampshire that Alan Eaton described. What kind of landscapes, either at the backyard level or the community level, do ticks just love?
Ticks love edge habitat and moist leaf litter and areas like that. And edge habitat is what you can think of as sort of a key player in fragmented habitats. And so the edge habitat is what you see between more open grassy areas and then brushy shrubby areas leading into the woods. And that's a perfect area also for deer to browse, mice to be foraging. So it sets up a really nice community for the ticks to be living.
That sounds like a lot of New Hampshire.
It does sound like a lot of New Hampshire.
People have a nice house, and then they have a backyard. And then, oh, it's great. They've got the woods in their backyard, and they can go out and enjoy the woods. But that edge zone is what you're talking about, Abby?
Yes. And so that also has played a little bit of a role in allowing the tick population to blossom here. As outlined in the plan, or stated in the plan, many years ago, centuries ago, 150 years ago about, a lot of New Hampshire had been cleared for farming. And then later on, we had a regreening of the landscape as people were doing farm abandonment, moving into the cities and things like that.
And moving out west where the farmland was
west,
better.
Yeah. And then we had another movement to get back into the woods where people were then creating wonderful homesteads for themselves, living in the woods, enjoying the woods like you should in New Hampshire. But that has also allowed people to interact more intimately with the environment, including ticks.
So these fragmented forests, you know, when the forest is broken up and then there's a house and then there's a lawn and then there's forest, that's prime tick habitat, that zone in between the backyard and the forest. Alan, you're nodding. I'd love your answer to that question, too. What kind of habitat do ticks just love?
I think Abby hit it right on the head. The mortality factor that kills most ticks is drying out. And that explains why the thick, shrubby, brush, tall grass are where they survive the best. And that's exactly right. And, of course, a lot of these anthropomorphic change, these human-caused changes to the environment, including putting houses in the edges of woods, but then also adding bird feeders. I've got one in my yard. And that helps encourage the mouse populations. And so this, I have a wood pile. That's where the white-footed mice nests are in my yard. So you do all these various things that we love to do, and it's really increasing our risk. We're getting closer and closer and encountering these things more frequently. It's all the more reason to do a daily tick check so that you don't become one of these victims.
But also maybe to make some changes, Alan. I mean, some of them, that was what I found encouraging. If there's anything positive about this report, there are some encouraging, easy things you can do. Alan, like you said, okay, take down the bird feeder from, you know, May to September. Because birds can also carry ticks, right? Other little changes that people can make in their own backyards.
Well, the reason I was hitting the bird feeders was because the spill stuff ends up feeding the mice and encourages mice and chipmunks, and both of them are reservoir hosts for this particular spirochete. But there are other changes as well. Moving play equipment away from wood's edge is an example of something. Pruning, cutting, mowing so that the sunshine gets into your, rather than having thick and dense, all those kinds of things can help. There's a number of those that I list in my publication. Abby made sure to link a good source of that information into the plan so that people can look for the specifics. All of those are things you can do in addition to, if you wish, using repellents, spraying an insecticide on your property if you wish. There's a lot of stuff. Some of the easiest, if you're managing a campground or something, some of the easiest ways to reduce risk is to put up signs reminding visitors that ticks are present or this is the time of year when they're there. I tell my listeners when I'm giving lectures that you control the risk, the lion's share of the risk. You can tremendously increase or tremendously decrease depending on what you do.
And again, the report is on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you're right, Alan, there's a ton of links embedded in the report, all sorts of useful information. Let's go back to our listeners again. The number 1-800-892-6477. Sean's in North Conway. Hi, Sean. Thanks for calling into the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've heard over the last couple of years many stories about the association of Lyme disease with Japanese knotweed, which is a highly invasive plant running around our state right now. But I've heard that the cure to Lyme disease is basically a product of Japanese knotweed. And on top of that, I've been told that Japanese knotweed is geographically following the Lyme disease around our state.
You know, this is a great point, Sean. And I think in the report, you talk about invasive species, Abby, and how some of them, ticks, just love it.
I do talk about that. And if the Japanese knotweed is the same thing as Japanese barberry, I talk specifically about that, and there have been some really good studies looking at that. And what that invasive plant is able to do is create this perfect microclimate for ticks. So as Alan was saying earlier, ticks love humidity and can't handle any of the drying or desiccation that you would have in the open areas. And the Japanese barberry is very good at creating these just wonderfully humid habitats relative to the other environment. It also serves as a really good habitat for mice, and so it sets up a really good almost perfect storm of tick habitat. And with the mouse being the primary and reservoir for the pathogen, it is a problem because then you can also increase your prevalence of infection of the ticks.
All right. So if you've got Japanese barberry or knotweed, whatever you want to call it, in your backyard, nearby, get rid of it.
Get rid of it. It's also illegal to have in New Hampshire.
Yes. One of those invasive species. Go ahead, Alan.
They are two different species, and the research that was done in Connecticut was done on barberry. Both Abby and I picked up on that right away. But knotweed is here as well, and I haven't yet seen any studies on it. It could be that they're out there and I'm just unaware, but we know the work has been done on Japanese barberry.
Well, thanks for that call, Sean. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in from Aubrey, and I want to share this with everybody and get your thoughts. Aubrey says, as an environmental educator and science teacher, I struggle with how best to teach about ticks because A, we don't want to scare kids, and B, we want them to go outside. Health risks of not being in the outdoors, mental, physical, developmental, are of even greater concern. She's got a couple more points, but I'd love your thoughts on that too. Dr. Chan, you know, you want to educate people, but boy, you need to get kids outside.
Yeah, this is a great question because we want kids to get outside and everybody to get outside and play. And in fact, it's important for everybody's health and sometimes occupation as well to get outside. I think one of the key things is to make it routine. You know, the things that I think upset or sometimes frighten kids are when there's a big deal made out of something new. And if it's a routine practice, I know with my kids, we have a habit of, you know, every day in the evening when they come inside, we say, time for a tick check. And they're used to it, and they know that it's part of the normal routine.
Yeah. So they don't flip out about it.
Correct.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'd love your thoughts on that too, Abby.
Well, I would just like to add to that. We are working on creating educational curricula for students. And so we're going through and piloting our first rounds of that. And we're hoping by the end of this calendar year to have a full set for K through 5 for kids to go through. And right now we've been working on a tick activity book. So it will help to normalize some of these behaviors. And they'll hopefully take some of this information home to parents. So then they can say, why don't we do tick checks? We learned about tick checks today in school. We learned about repellents or anything like that that we have materials for. We're going to be talking about risky habitat areas so kids can understand how better to interact with their environment and try and take some of that fear out of it. Because we all do agree that kids need to be out there and exercising. New Hampshire's a beautiful state and people should be enjoying it.
Well, and you'll love the second part of this email from Aubrey Allen Eaton. She says, what I found that works, because again, she's an environmental educator, teach kids from a very young age about ticks. One, how to ID them. Is it male? Is it female? What type is it? This can even be made into a game, Aubrey says. Where to look for them on your body? What types of habitat ticks especially like? And then she says, as you all have said, model a calm demeanor. There's nothing that freaks kids out more if the adult in the situation is freaking out. So she's almost saying, look, as an environmental educator, make it almost kind of cool and interesting. Go ahead, Alan.
It just brings to mind the tick rap, which we still haven't recorded yet, but we try to do games and things.
Wait, you have a tick rap?
Yeah, I wrote a tick rap in 2002, and we haven't recorded it yet, but we've done it repeatedly at presentations.
Can you do a little for us now?
No.
Please?
It's a participation call and response thing, and I need
okay.
a bar-on player.
Fair
and,
enough.
And, that's just the kind of stuff. It was designed to make it fun and if you remember jokes, you remember things, it helps with learning. So it's designed to make it less scary and have fun. So
Aubrey,
we're going to get it recorded soon.
Do, please. And Aubrey, thank you very much for the email. Let's go back to our callers. And Bob is in Exeter. Hi, Bob. You're on the exchange. Go ahead. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. Go ahead. What's your question?
My question is, I've been listening to this broadcast. What percentage of black legged ticks actually carry a Lyme disease pathogen?
Okay. A little bit of a bad phone line there, but I think for you, Alan Eaton, what percentage of the black-legged ticks are carrying the pathogen that causes Lyme?
We have a study in front of us on the table that shows the average by different counties in the state when they were looking at the adults, and this was a study that was done between 2007 and 2010 that showed it ranged anywhere from very, very low amounts, less than 25% found in some spots, to over 70 or 80%. The average was something like 60. Have we got more recent data than this, Abby? I don't know if we've got 1,000 ticks I sent to the state labs 2 months ago, but I don't think that data is in yet.
Yeah, so it couldn't range,
so,
depending on where
so
you are.
So it ranges,
in the state.
But in many places it's 50 to 60%.
Wow.
Did you want to correct me on that?
What? No correction yet. We're just finishing up all the testing in the lab, and we will hopefully be able to do the data analysis in the very near future. And when that is finished, we'll of course post that on our website along, and we'll leave this study up with it so people can look at if there's been any changes.
And those numbers I gave are for the adults of black-legged ticks. So if you were bitten by a nymph, we would expect the incidence rate to be half of that, because nymphs have only had one chance in their life to have picked it up, whereas an adult has had two chances, so twice the infection rate.
Well, and getting to the cost of testing, here's an email from Jim in Bedford. We submitted a tick to be tested via a local New Hampshire hospital and were billed over $500. The tick and our trust of that supplier did not survive. Wow. The human treatment, Jim says, costs less and is more likely to be covered. What about that, Dr. Chan? How do people typically cover the costs of not just getting the treatment, but getting the test? It seems like it's two different things here.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have specifics about the cost of the antibiotics that we use to treat Lyme disease, but it's not recommended that people out in the community, if they find a tick, send it in for testing for a number of reasons. One is that just because a tick might test positive for Lyme disease doesn't necessarily mean that tick transmitted the infection to the person, because remember, there's a lot of different factors that go into an infection. And also, by the time you get the results back, there can be quite a delay. And so the recommendation is to focus around the treatment of the person,
the patient,
and testing
sure.
the person.
All right. Thank you for that email, Jim. We'll take more of your emails, questions, comments after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour in The Exchange, we're getting the latest on ticks in New Hampshire and the prevalence of Lyme disease carried by the black-legged tick. You can join us. Call in with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go back to the phones and go to Julie in Barrington. Hi, Julie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I am a physician at a walk-in care and also a mom of three children under the age of 11. Everyone in our neighborhood has had someone or a pet with Lyme disease.
Wow.
So I have been researching the four-poster tickicide, and it is a device that treats passively deer as you feed them with permethrin. And it has been very well studied by Cornell at Shelter and Fire Island. Yet when I called Concord, the state capital, to get permission, they said, we are not allowed to drug animals in the state of New Hampshire. And they considered putting permethrin on the deer as drugging. So it's very hard as a mom to understand. We can put DEET on ourselves, but we can't decrease the black-legged deer tick population, which I think one of your specialists said about how it's increasing. And here's a way that's been proven to decrease, but it would require a research permit and an agricultural permit to use in New Hampshire.
Wow, Julie, you've really done your homework. Thank you for calling. And Alan, permethrin, just remind us what that is.
Permethrin is an insecticide, one of the pyrethroids, and it is extremely effective at killing ticks. And so it's being used as a treatment for spraying on clothing. It's being used in traps. It's being used at the tick boxes she may not know about. And it's a material that has been very effective in killing black-legged ticks and others.
Is it available in just like an over-the-counter spray? You spray it on your socks
actually,
or your shoes?
There are some forms that are available where you have to take off your pants first, and then you spray it and let it dry. That and other materials, sometimes fipronil is being used in some of these methods as well. There's one thing I want to point out that she might not have known about, and that is available close to Barrington, and that is the tick boxes. We have a former student named Tom Prey who has a company called, it might be called EcoHealth. He's located in southern Maine, and he offers tick boxes, and that's a version of the think of a mini four-poster. It's designed to treat the mice when they go in and feed on the bait, but you can only get it through a contract with a pest control company. They come every week and manage it and make sure it's set properly and so forth. And it's the same idea except aiming at the mice. You're treating the mice in your yard instead of treating the deer, and that's an option that is available, and it's covered in my publication, and I think we covered in the management plan, the prevention plan as well. When I asked Dan Bergeron, who is a Fish and Game's deer a biologist heading their deer program, and asked about questions about four posters, they're concerned for several reasons. And one of them is that one of their concerns, if I remember it correctly, is that when we concentrate deer, which this tends to do, we increase the risk of having deer pass diseases between each other. They're worried about a number of those. That's one concern. And they're also concerned about levels of these materials in the animals that might occur at hunting time when hunters are out there. And there may be other concerns as well, but there's a couple that I can think of. So there are some problems, but there are also some advantages and possibilities, including the tick boxes method.
Well, I'm glad you called, Julie. I have a question for you, Dr. Chen, but I can see you want to jump in, Abby, too. In your report, there's a lot of discussion about various wildlife management approaches, the birds, the white-footed mouse, the deer, and so forth.
I just wanted to add a couple other things to what Alan was saying about the four posters. You need to have a certain density of those per square mile for them to be effective. You also have to maintain them 2 to 3 times a week minimally to make sure they're not clogging for the corn to be coming out or whatever grain mix you're using to attract the deer. And they're very expensive to run. And it's something that you need to have a real commitment to within your community. One single person cannot do this kind of intervention. It also may change the way that people are allowed to hunt because they're considered then baited areas. And so it'll be concentrating the deer not just for disease transmission like chronic wasting disease. It can also attract rabies-carrying raccoons. And so there are many, many considerations that you need to think about when you're talking about having an intervention like that.
So just to clarify for people, these four posters that you guys are talking about are sort of boxes of food that the deer like to eat, and they come and eat it. And as they're eating it, they get treated with permethrin?
Yeah, and the sides are treated with the stuff so the deer rubs its neck as it gets its head in, and that's how it happens to hit the material that has its absorbent material that's coated with the permethrin.
And the mice will come as well and get coated with permethrin. Is that what you were saying or no?
In the mini version, in the tick boxes, it's slightly different material but the same idea.
Wow. Well, and talking about sprays, DEET, and this other type of anti-tick medicine, if I could call it that, or spray, Dr. Chen, I mean, are there concerns about spraying yourself with DEET 5 times a day? I mean, is that a concern? That's a pretty harsh chemical. Or permethrin.
Well, so the permethrin doesn't go on the skin. The way you apply the permethrin, and you can buy these sprays at any outdoor store. You can go and buy these permethrin sprays, and if you go in and ask, people can point you in the right directions. But so it can get confusing because there's different sprays for different clothing, different parts of the body. The permethrin, you're supposed to, as Dr. Eaton mentioned, you're supposed to spray it on your clothes and let it dry. so it's not supposed to actually be sprayed on the skin.
I see.
The insect repellents, there are a variety of different types of insect repellents out there, some containing DEET and some not. The ones with DEET tend to be the most effective, and so that's what's recommended. And as with anything you ingest or put on your body, there's sort of this risk-benefit decision that goes into it, and some people may not like to use DEET, but it is effective. And the alternatives of getting bitten by a tick or some other insect and getting infections are not good either. So,
has anybody studied the long term effects of daily DEET spraying for the 3 months, 4 months that we tend to be running around in the grass?
I'm not aware of I'm sure there are studies out there, but I'm not aware of any studies looking at the long-term health effects of DEET.
Well, here's an email that came in from Tim, who says, can your guests comment on data on how effective cedar oil is for tick prevention? There are a number of companies providing application of this, and it seems preferable to permethrin, which also affects, for example, bees. Tim, thanks for that email. And Dr. Chan, I'll throw that to you as well. I also came across some information that talked about oregano oil. So what do you think about these various alternative approaches towards keeping ticks off your body?
That's a good question. As I mentioned, there's a lot of different substances out there that people use or try to use to prevent insects. Or insect bites. I don't have a lot of data on some of these more natural or organic remedies. And again, I think that the most effective repellent that we have is DEET.
Do you want to jump in, Alan Eaton?
And I had a question. Did she ask about them as repellents or as tick-killing agents? Because the answer is different for...
She says tick prevention. Tim, he says how effective cedar oil is for tick prevention.
So I like that answer relative to the repellents. And I have a publication on repellents, which we have linked to. But also there are some natural products that are used as tick-killing agents, and some of them can be very effective. I'm unaware specifically about the efficacy of cedar oil, and I liked that answer about if it as a repellent. We know which ones are effective. There's a whole bunch of others that are not tested, and if they're natural, don't have to be tested to be legal to be sold, which can be a bit of a problem.
Let's take another call. This is Steve in Warner. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if there's any natural predators of ticks.
Natural predators of ticks. Great question, Steve. Thank you very much for calling in. Alan, you first, but then I have a question for the rest of you. Yeah.
We know that there's a number of things that will feed on them once in a while when they happen to stumble across them. But right here, we don't have too many things that sort of focus on ticks. So there are lots of ways that ticks die, but predators, parasitoids, not so much.
Mm.
We repeatedly hear about certain birds that might remove them, including guinea hens and so forth. And I've been looking through the literature like mad, desperate to find any study that tested it to see if, and I can find no scientific evidence.
Well, and a Facebook comment from Rebecca, she says, I can't wait for the guinea hens to start devouring the ticks. She also says, my son found a tick on him yesterday, not really embedded, not full of blood. Does that mean it wasn't on long, less than the 24 hours needed for transmission? Dr. Chan, it's hard to, obviously I'm not going to ask you to diagnose somebody on the air, but if there's not a lot of blood in a tick, can you kind of breathe a sigh of relief or no?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think this gets at the question of how to prevent infection. And there is an antibiotic out there that's approved for prevention of Lyme disease after a tick bite. And that is a very common antibiotic called doxycycline. And it's healthcare providers can give it in a single dose, and it's been shown to be upwards of 80% effective at reducing the development of the Lyme rash, the bullseye rash, after a tick bite. There's some criteria for when people should be given that, one of which is that the tick should be attached for at least 36 hours, because remember, it takes 2 to 3 days for the bacteria to migrate from the gut of the tick into the person that it's biting. And so the time limit of it being attached for at least 36 hours is meant to get at the fact that it takes about that time, if not a little longer, for the bacteria to infect the person. So it's important to try and figure out maybe when the person was bitten by the tick, but oftentimes as a surrogate, you can go by degree of engorgement of the tick. So an unengorged tick means that it probably has not been feeding and has not had a chance to transmit the bacteria from the tick into the person. Now, obviously, as you said, I don't want to try and give medical advice over the radio. So if somebody's concerned, they should certainly call their healthcare provider and discuss it with them. And healthcare provider may decide ultimately to prescribe this single dose of antibiotic. But that's up to the discussion between them and their healthcare provider.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for the Facebook comment. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. You know, Abby, we started out talking about the new plan that Health and Human Services put out, talking about tick prevention and so forth. We've got a link to that on our website. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. But we've been talking about ticks for a long time in this state. Alan Eaton's been on this program a number of years. What jumps out from this new report that you guys did that, you know, a lot of people might think, wow, I didn't know that?
I don't think people were really aware of the landscape changes that they can do to take more ownership of the risks that they're exposing themselves to every single day. When I've talked with people about that so far this spring, there has not been much awareness of those kinds of activities that you can do to minimize the risk that you have.
And Alan touched on it earlier, but just some small things that, you know, we as homeowners or communities could do. We talked earlier, for example, about trying to get rid of the invasive species. And you talked about that sort of edge between the woods and your backyard. But what are some just easy things that folks can do to minimize the ticks in their own backyards?
Being mindful about removing leaf litter, that's a perfect habitat. So raking up leaves in the fall, perhaps, but also wearing protective equipment. So the long pants, tucking them into your socks, perhaps wearing sort of knee-high-ish rubber boots to help ticks not be able to cling on to you if you encounter them. Removing that kind of habitat for them before the snow falls will help them not have as much area for them to hide in the wintertime and be protected.
You guys also had something in there about, in terms of that that zone between sort of the woods and the backyard, maybe putting like a foot or two of mulch, right? Because the ticks don't want to crawl over it. Is that?
You want to have about 3 feet of either mulch or pea gravel, something like that, that ticks will not want to crawl across because they prefer to crawl up. So having something like that will also expose them to sun rays and drying out, things like that. There are some really good images on the CDC website and in Kirby Stafford's guide out of the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station about what things look like before and after interventions. So yards, play areas, anything like that. Another area that I would like to see, and I think people in the state would like to see a focus on, is trying to do these kinds of landscape management activities around community areas as well. So
yeah, it's not just homeowners. Go ahead.
It's not just homeowners. So if there are multifamily residences where there's play equipment or shared space of some sort around schools, daycares, anything where there are people at risk out there interacting with the environment, it would be good to do these kinds of activities there too.
Well, it's interesting. There's a park in Concord where tons of kids play, and people love this park because it's got a woodsy area, and then it has a huge play structure, huge. And the play structure is on wood chips. So maybe that's the type of management that you're talking about.
That sounds perfect.
Okay.
I think we've been to that park. It's very nice.
Let's take another call. This is Paula in Meredith. Hi, Paula. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Yes. I was just wondering. I'm actually a nurse in New Hampshire. And one of the alarming things to me is that I take care of an increasing number of patients with Lyme disease. And it's not just Lyme disease, it's advanced Lyme disease. I take care of patients that are very debilitated and have cardiac disease and neurological disease. And every patient that I have had has had a negative Western blot. I think that's the test. And I'm just wondering why it's so hard to detect, and if there are other tests that are more specific, or if they're trying to come up with more testing that is more specific to finding out earlier.
Paula, this is a great question. And Dr. Chan, I was just reading about this morning. There have been problems with the antibody test. You know, people test positive and they don't have it. People test negative and they do. And then, as our caller says, the symptoms go on and it does get serious. As you described earlier, why is the test so poor?
Well, so that's a great question. And there's a lot of confusion and around this specific issue. And who you ask, you'll get a different answer on this. There are, as I mentioned earlier, there are different stages of Lyme disease. Some of the later stages can involve heart complications and neurologic complications. There is also a syndrome that is referred to as post-Lyme syndrome, and some people call this chronic Lyme disease. And the differentiation is important because if you call something a disease, it implies that there is a specific treatment or ongoing infection, and that's not clear that that's the case. So there are a percentage of people that get Lyme disease and are treated, and afterwards about 10 to 20% can have these lingering post-Lyme symptoms and syndrome. And it's not clear how to treat these patients or even what the cause of the symptoms are. So the tests we have to detect antibodies, we think, are pretty good. And so people can certainly have symptoms or have the disease. But if they have ongoing infection or had infection, the antibody test should be positive. What we don't have is a great test to see if they've cleared the infection.
Okay. We will close it out at that. I want to thank everybody very much for coming in. Alanine, I'm still waiting for that rap song about ticks. So we'll play that for you the next time. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.